Friday.
Hello, I'm Douglas Kretz. This is the BizSpark Show. We're shooting live in Microsoft's Silicon Valley headquarters in Mountain View, which is on La Avenida. It's a little bit, I guess, east of Castro Street. That's for our guest today, so she knows where to find it the next time. Anyway, I'm here. I'm very pleased to be here with Stephanie Palmieri. She's a principal at SoftTech VC, a micro VC firm that was started by Jeff Clavier. Many of you probably know Jeff Clavier. If you don't know Stephanie Palmieri, that's because she's really only been in the game for about two and a half years.
Yep.
And she has moved from New York to Silicon Valley. She's based mostly out of San Francisco area. And she is here to talk to us today about what founders really need to know and about the VC process. And she wants to work with us tonight or today to kind of just demystify what's going on. First, we'll let Stephanie tell us a little bit about herself. She comes from New York. You went to Columbia. You
I
have
went
an MBA,
to Columbia
right?
For my MBA. I was in New York for 10 years.
Yes.
So I still consider myself a bit of a New Yorker.
You can never lose New York.
No. But I'm really happy here in California.
Yes.
So that's good.
Good.
Yeah. My background. This is the first time I've worked in venture. So I've mm-hmm. been at SoftTech since July of 2011, and before that I started my career at Accenture. I did marketing at Estee Lauder for a number of years. I worked mm-hmm. at startups in New York, and did some seed investing and ran an incubator program in New York.
Wow.
While I was in business school, and then moved out here in 2011 with literally two suitcases.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Wow, we actually share a similar story, except I wasn't involved in investing. I also moved here with two suitcases, and then I had to go back because I left my birth certificate, and I had to, well, anyway, long story.
I had to go back too. So.
Did you? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, many times.
So. What before we get into sort of the demystification process, let me ask you, what was the thing that kind of triggered you to want to get into investing once you, I mean, you had so many different
things
in your background.
Yeah. I think that's part of it, like variety. So for me, the ability to have every day be slightly different and to constantly be learning and seeing new things. And I think early stage in particular was really exciting for me because it's a lot about building relationships and developing relationships with founders.
Right.
And that's, I think at the end of the day, that's what I enjoy the most about what I do.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So you kind of enjoy the repartee and the relationship building and stuff.
And you know, and it's cool. I mean, I've always been interested in the intersection of technology and business.
Yeah.
And so to kind of be at the forefront of that is really exciting.
Awesome. And for those out there who don't know, what is the kind of target area for SoftTech?
We invest across a pretty broad spectrum.
Okay.
So we do about 20 deals a year. So in those 20 deals a year, we do a mix of B2B, so enterprise, B2B2C, and then mm-hmm. B2C, so traditional consumer.
Right.
And so I'd say the main categories we look at are commerce and marketplaces, cloud services and infrastructure, and mobile SaaS and infrastructure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. All right. So I floated out some opportunities for our audience to ask you some questions.
Awesome.
And I actually got immediate responses for a few of them. Both of them are kind of in this general area about what are U.S. investors interested in?
Okay.
Like what do you think is exciting for a U.S. VC investor? The second one, though, was something a lot more urgent and very compelling, and I think
okay.
we'll lead with that one, which is, are VC investors sort of blowing smoke? Like, they always talk about, and I'm just giving the general gist
sure.
of this question. This is from a guy named Jerry Reynolds, who's the founder of Plandry, which is also a BizSpark member.
Thanks, Jerry.
He was like, are you pretty much blowing smoke? Because you're always talking about VCs in general. It's all about the founder. What kind of investment we make really depends on the deal, and it depends on the product. What do we really have to know if we want to go into a meeting with you
okay.
and impress you about what it is we're doing?
Okay, so for context, you know, for your audience, I think it's helpful to know. I'm a micro VC, so we invest in companies that are probably raising somewhere between $500,000 to $2 million.
Right.
So raising seed money, they've probably already raised a bit of angel friends and family money. And for us, we typically are investing in companies that are at least have a product that's prototyped,
yeah.
but most likely is a live product. So with that in mind, there's three major things we look for. Can I say it?
Yes. Oh, you
it's
have
it's
to say
television.
It. This is the most okay. compelling thing that's ever
okay,
come out
so
of.
So SoftTech has something called the three asses rule.
Three asses.
And so All it's right. true. We do really care about founders. They're our first ass.
not to be confused with a sass.
No, not to be confused with a sass.
It's an ass.
It's an ass. A-S-S. Like a donkey.
Okay.
Like a donkey. And so the first ass is a smart ass team. And
yeah.
so ultimately, the stage we're investing at, there's still a tremendous amount of risk. You may not have product market fit yet. The company is very early. It's raised very little capital. It has probably just the core founding members of the team and very few other team members. And so it's really dependent on those people being the right people on the boat to steer that boat, right?
Right.
So team is incredibly important. Second thing we look for is the product.
Yeah.
And so it does mean having a product that's been built.
Yes.
That's been tested with users, that maybe is beginning to get some traction, whether it's users, whether it's actually revenue. And then the third piece is market. And that's either you're in a big enough market or you're not. And that's that sounds very simple when I say it that way. But, you know, you've got to be in a $1 billion market or more, because ideally you're going to capture a certain percentage of that market, and we need to see that the company can get to, say, $100 million run rate in a few years out. And so what does it take to do that? Well, you need a market that's big enough to do that.
Are there other more maybe like granular and really pragmatic things?
Sure.
Like I had heard in Jeff Clavier's interview with Jason Calcanis that you have to have a deck ready first. You have to at least be able to show the team some kind of graphic representation of what you do and what it means.
I mean, we definitely don't invest in just an idea, right? And even an idea on paper or a deck is too little for us.
Okay.
I'd say, you know, one of the important things I kind of mentioned to a lot of founders is looking at our existing portfolio and asking, are you competitive with companies in the portfolio? Because if we think that there's going to be some overlap at a certain point in time, we pass out, right? There's a conflict there. Something else we think about, and I think this is really important in this era right now, is the fundable trajectory of that company for the next series of rounds the company's going to raise. So, you know, we see consumer go in and out of vogue, right? And so right now, if you're building a social media app, is this the best time to go raise a Series A, a Series B, and beyond? Probably not. So that
And why is that for the, I mean, what's the limiting factor there?
I think we've seen, there's just been a slowdown in interest in, you know, we've got a number of hits already. They tend to be relatively binary. I mean, they're companies that are based around building a really large user base and having high engagement and figuring out monetization later. And we, in general, at Zoptech, like to know the clear path to monetization, so we don't do a lot of that stuff to begin with. But, you know, right now, the investment community just isn't excited about stuff like that. And so what that means is, if you're going to invest in a company like that, you've got to think about what that life cycle looks like beyond the seed round. Will there be a funding path for it? So we do think about that, too. We try not to be influenced by what others are doing, but you also have to think about what the market conditions are.
Well, yeah, and generally speaking, where you see other investments being made, that's some kind of proof that the thesis is correct, that other people are interested. So you have
there's areas. I mean,
it's a social exercise.
Hot, areas, you know. I mean, right now, hardware is really interesting.
Yeah.
Internet of Things, and so, and yet we haven't seen a ton of activity at the later stages with investors in that space, but we're beginning to see more of it. And so as we see more investors being willing to invest in that category, then arguably there will be more seed money flowing into that category.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about a recent example of a team that your firm has funded. Let's talk about Ubuli, right?
Okay. Yeah, because that Ubuli. I always pronounce
Ubuli.
It
Ubuli.
Ubuli. Or Ubuli.
God, I really apologize to the founders of this company for not knowing how the hell to say your name. But they are an interesting case. Can you walk me through sort of you all have made a pretty large initial investment in them, but they also have Kickstarter they have two Kickstarter campaigns that they kicked off to fund their product. What is that all
so
about?
So let me give you the history of the company. It's probably helpful. So Ubuli launched, they were on Kickstarter well over, they were in it would have been spring of 2012.
Okay.
They went on Kickstarter to raise the initial capital for the product. And for those of you that don't know what
it is. For those of you don't know what it is, we're talking about this thing that you really want. You totally want
this
now.
It's this awesome stuffed animal. The original one was orange. There's now other colors. And you slide a smartphone into it.
Yeah.
And it becomes alive. And it's targeted at kids ages 4 to 12.
Yeah.
And it's an interactive education toy.
Yeah.
It plays games. It tells stories. It sings.
It's a much more versatile Teddy Ruxpin, basically. When you're done with it, you can slide it into your pocket.
That's a really good way to put it. And you can actually play with Ubuli when it's not in the toy, too.
Got it.
And if you're an adult, Ubuli tells really funny jokes.
Yeah.
If you've had a couple glasses of wine.
So is this also like the Vibes app that reads 50 Shades of Grey? We're not dealing with the same.
There's no Ubuli after dark as far as I know.
Just mentioning a Bizpark company there for everyone out there. So
they went on
Kickstarter
initially.
They went on Kickstarter
and
first.
And then they ended up going through Techstars Boulder.
Okay.
And then we met them in, through Techstars Boulder, mm-hmm. and we funded them coming out of that summer batch in 2012.
Okay.
And so I've been working with them for about a year now.
Yes.
And so the initial Kickstarter money was a way for them to get some social proof points around would people actually buy the product.
Right.
And one of the cool things that the team learned was there was some there was a lot of demand from international markets to have an English-speaking toy, but also to have a toy that could speak a foreign language. Because, well, it might make sense to manufacture Teddy Ruxpin for an English-speaking audience. It probably doesn't make sense to do it in French or German or languages where there just aren't there isn't a big enough audience. But the cool thing with the iPhone and Android and all the software is that you can actually do that now. Mm-hmm. Right? You can actually do these translations really easily, and any toy can speak any language. And so we got a lot of market data through that Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. And so fast forward a year later, year and a half later, the team is now moving Oobly international. And that's really fast for a company that's only been around for about a year. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is not only will Oobly speak foreign languages and teach foreign languages to American children, but Oobly will also speak French and Japanese.
Nice.
It's really cute.
And then presumably you're also going to be able to capture data about what those other international audiences
are using.
Yeah,
and so we went back on Kickstarter for two reasons.
Yeah.
The first was sort of a thank you / marketing reason, which was Kickstarter was the first community that supported Oobly, and it was a way to go back and thank the Kickstarter audience and give them some exclusives. So I'll do a little plug here. There's blue Ooblies available if you back the Kickstarter campaign.
And she's looking at the camera so that you know that she's really sincere about this.
I actually backed it myself. Go look for personally those backed it.
Ooblies.
Okay. So there's blue and there's t-shirts and there's all this cool stuff for like real big Oobly fans.
Yeah.
But the other thing we're looking to do is get more market data, especially around this internationalization and to see where this demand is coming from. And I was reading through the comments on the campaign. It just kicked off yesterday. And somebody was like, oh, are you guys going to do Arabic next? And I mean, that's pretty cool to think about, right?
Yeah.
And so we'll see where we're getting demand for languages. But, you know, and what it takes is a voice actress to record Oobly in that language and some tweaking with teachers in that country to kind of make sure the content is appropriate.
So then where exactly is the funding from a VC investment going for a company like that? I mean, if they have the luxury of also turning to this Kickstarter platform.
So
how does that work?
When a company like that raises on Kickstarter, or any of these companies that raise on Kickstarter, they're funding some initial prototyping or a batch run, but they're not funding the long-term cycle of the company.
Yeah.
Kickstarter in many ways is, it's what I think, you know, the web-enabled software companies to do, which is let's put something quick out there and see if people take to it, and then we'll put more money in to actually do this, you know, bigger and better.
Yeah.
And that's what Kickstarter is allowing hardware companies to do. It's a it's a way to say, hey, let's see if people are interested in buying this watch or this water filter.
It's a plug-in for marketing analytics, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And it's market testing.
It's testing.
You know, and it's instead of going out to these, you know, market user groups and sitting around a table for an hour and asking, would you use this theoretical product over and over and over again?
Yeah.
You've got a bunch of people that are actually putting their money and saying, here, I'll give you my credit card so that I can buy this product 6 months or a year from now.
Does having an investment partner like a VC actually also enable that a hardware company to work with larger, more established players, like at the enterprise level?
Yeah.
How do you walk them through the door in that way?
$1.5 million from us and from TransLink, which is actually a Japanese investor. And part of the reason was we saw a lot of value in having an international player in this particular company. And so the capital that Oobly's raised is capital that's going towards, you know, a lot of it's going towards engineering, right? Hiring a team, towards distribution, which is a big thing, you know, getting into various retailers and distributors, towards marketing and things like that. So Kickstarter's a great platform, but our entire audience for Oobly is not on Kickstarter.
Do you have like a three asses for what to do with our money kind of thing?
For
like,
what to do with
I mean, are there three, like if you were to break it down, is there some sort of like
early
heat
on,
map or,
no,
I mean?
Not necessarily. I think it's dependent on each company.
Yeah.
So, you know, a company that has a physical product, there is actually going to be working capital deployed to building that physical product.
Right.
So that's why you, part of the reason you're raising money.
Yeah.
And one of the great things is, you know, companies in that situation can also potentially raise debt as well. You know, and so it's in, you can do a kind of a combination debt and equity, but on top of that, I'd say engineering or hires is probably one of the biggest things, and then marketing is a spend that it depends on what the product is and how you market the product early on, but you're going to at least do some experimentation with marketing early on and building out a sales team
A founder or his founding or her founding team go to you with an actual roadmap laid out for you to know this is exactly how we want to use.
Oh, you mean like a really detailed business plan?
Well, I mean, you mean like the you know, like a deck. There's no, like
yeah,
a,
yeah.
No,
a
but
deck
I mean,
is helpful, but
because we've had so many different varieties of bootstrap companies walk through these doors.
Yeah.
And even on this show, and we've seen everyone sort of say, well, we don't need VC.
Oh,
we
right.
can just use our own bootstrap cash and we'll just hire an Odesk, you know, person. Or we've seen people also say, well, we need, you know, $250,000 because we want to hire this engineer and this person.
Okay, so here's...
And they actually know who they are.
That's... Okay, so that's a... So we like to see a lot of that thought, which is I kind of know what I need on my team. But here's how I typically advise founders to think about this when you're putting it together, which is... Seed round, you want to have at least 18 months of runway.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have about a year of operating the company. About it takes about 3 months to raise a round. Maybe you raise it really quickly, but most of the time it takes about 3 months to finally end-to-end put it together. And then you may give yourself another 3 months of cushioning.
Yeah.
Right? And so assuming all goes well and you've got this 18 months of capital, what are you going to do with that in that 18 months? And so I like to think about the milestones the company is going to achieve. Some of the milestones may be building out gaps in my team, right? It might be, you know, adding an iOS engineer or bringing on a director of marketing or, you know, adding 3 members to my sales team, right? You know, some of the other milestones are I'm going to, you know, figure out what my customer acquisition cost is, which means there's a marketing budget associated with it. It's product release milestones. Again, there's hires associated with that. So I like to think of it as what are the milestones your company is going to accomplish? And how do you determine what those milestones should be? Well, to a certain extent, as a founder, you want to come in and say to yourself, what am I going to prove with this 18 months or in this year that's going to get my company to the next level?
Right.
And so it might be a certain number of users. It might be a certain product milestones.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it could be a number of downloads. It could be a certain amount of revenue. So,
And I imagine with your, I know like, you know, for example, Sequoia, when they look at stuff, they have people on their teams that are huge data number crunchers. And they can just look at a spreadsheet and be like, these numbers are off. It doesn't work.
Spreadsheets, they're fiction if I'm looking at them, right?
You think Yeah.
For the most part, I mean, they're like... sounds bad when I say that, but the reality is I have no idea what's going to happen, and you have no idea what's going to happen if you're a few months in.
Right.
We can make some assumptions. So when I look at a spreadsheet coming from a founder, I'm not looking at it as fact.
Okay.
I'm not looking at you can predict the next, you know, year, 18 months, 3 years.
I hope not.
I mean, I don't have a crystal ball. I'm assuming the founder that I'm meeting.
So then what use is it to even have that?
I like to look at how they think. I like to look at how they think about the company scaling. So are they realistically projecting the number of users that they're going to get and how those numbers of users ramps, right? Do they have a really good sense of, with a physical product, do they have a really good sense of how long it's going to take to get into physical retail and where their sales are going to come for the first year and how they're going to ramp sales in each of the channels they're going to be selling?
Yeah.
And so it's really more of an understanding of where are they grounded in reality. And how do they see the business scaling? And do I believe that even if the numbers change, and they will change, that the founder has a good enough grasp to say, okay, I understand the impact of my business.
So give me some sense of what are some of the kind of questions you throw at a founder or that team to really test whether they are grounded in reality. But forget the spreadsheet. Let's say you want to pepper them with questions and be like, listen, buddy, are you really off your meds or what's going on? I mean, what do you ask these people?
One of the things I like to ask companies is, what do you think you need to prove in a year? Like, where will you be in a year and what will you have proven? Right. And I think that's very telling of whether or not the company is thinking big enough to get to the next level.
Right.
Right. And so, again, that could be, it could be for a SaaS company. It could be, I'm going to be doing $2 to $3 million run rate. Right. And I'm doing 10 to 20K run rate, you know, annually right now or monthly right now. So it's, so that's one of the things that I'm looking for. I always like to ask them where they think the gaps are on their team.
Yeah.
I really like to understand how they think about competitive landscape.
Have most teams that have come to your firm, whether you've done the deal directly or not, have they come with a full team? I mean, have they pretty much said this is the launching team? This is, you know, like you've got Fab, Fitbit, visually.
Yeah. I mean, most of these companies, the founding team is there.
Yeah.
But most of the companies we invest in will hire at least a handful of people. once they get started.
Right.
And that's kind of the difference between being a founder and being an early team member.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you've got real skin in the game, sweat equity if you're you're there before the funding comes in.
Yeah. Maybe some blood too.
Yeah.
You never know.
Maybe once in a while there's probably some blood.
I wonder if there's a lot of blood with Oobly or, you know,
no, maybe there's a lot of stuffing probably.
A lot of stuffing. Anyway, this is, we're talking with Stephanie Palmieri. And I was just going to say to my team over here, since I don't have any access to the comment stream, I don't know if anyone's asking me any questions. Is there, because I don't actually have any internet over here, though my computer's broken. Yeah, so what? Someone says that I look excited. I wanted to take a few moments to say we're talking with Stephanie Palmieri. This is the Microsoft BizSpark show. Now, for anyone who is involved in an early stage, pre-early stage funding startup, or you're a bootstrap startup, this program at BizSpark.com is basically a doorway into getting $15,000 worth of software for 3 years to grow whatever type of business you want, whether it's a mobile app, whether it's a cloud infrastructure business, whether it's some kind of SaaS something or other. You can use this software and the community that's involved in it to get introductions to the people you need to meet and to perhaps get a chance to be on this show and talk to me, who looks very excited. One of the great people we bring on our show are people like Stephanie Palmieri. So she's been walking us through sort of the demystification process of VC funding. I gather there's a lot of cynicism in founder communities, and some of that is centered, I think, on the distance apart from Silicon Valley. Like, I think people look on the horizon and they say, go west, young man, and they think, oh, well, if I just move my team there,
it'll just magically
I'll
happen.
Just sort of get into that network and whatnot. Is that true or not? I mean, is it a kind of a thing where Silicon Valley is your solution, or
not always?
No. And what's the gradient there?
Like,
how would you work that out?
I'm in a sense an outsider myself.
Yeah.
Right. So I could have stayed in New York and done this in New York.
Yeah.
And I chose to go west. So I do think that there's a lot of validity to being part of this ecosystem that's out here and experiencing it, even if it's not where you decide to build the company ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
Having relationships here and connections here is something that is, I think, very important, because a lot of the capital resides here at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So if you're a founder and you're in another market, eventually you're probably going to raise some money from here.
Sure.
So spending some time here can be helpful. That being said, you know, we meet teams from all over the country, all over North America. And there's pockets where we invest. So, you know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, Softech, when it was still just Jeff investing as a solo investor, mm-hmm. through the $15 million fund, I'm not sure how many investments we had outside of Silicon Valley, but it was probably fewer than five.
Mm-hmm.
And those were pretty unusual edge cases. And now we've got 10% of the portfolio is in New York. 5% or so is based up in based in Boulder.
Yeah.
And another 5% is actually now in the Toronto Waterloo region.
Nice.
And so what has to happen for us to get excited about another ecosystem is feeling as though there's the ability for a founder and the founding team to build an interesting company, to hire the right people in that mm-hmm. area. Potentially the customer may actually be in that area. So mm-hmm. there's
some
real advantages.
You're talking geography, right?
Yeah. And then we as investors, if we want to like look outside of Silicon Valley, we like to know that there's a strong syndicate, including investors that are local to that company. And the reason for that is, I mean, we're seed investors.
Yeah.
So we're investing really early. It's awesome when I can walk down the street and grab coffee or a drink at the end of the day, with like one of my founders who's got a problem they want to talk through.
Yeah.
And I do it all the time. But I can't really do that when the founders, you know, across the country. So
sure.
I need to know that they've got that sounding board locally, and then I can spend some quality time when I actually travel, and the founder can spend some quality time when they come travel out here.
So what, now that the rules for general solicitation have changed, I think that's a really important topic, because mm-hmm. those changed yesterday, right? What does that do to a firm like yours? Is that a challenge to you guys? Is it competitive? Is it something that you can leverage?
I mean, I think it's premature for me to say exactly what the impact is going to be, but I don't see it being that significant for a more established institutional firm.
Yeah.
I think good founders are going to be critical about the capital they take in.
Yeah.
I think as a founder, there's actually a lot of...
This is a good point. I think I know where you're going.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's... You know, so now with the changes in the law, and I, you know, hopefully I get this completely correct, but essentially... You can now, anybody who's an accredited investor or qualifies as an accredited investor, you can approach, but you actually, as the founder, have to verify that they are. And so there's just a lot more legal paperwork.
Interesting.
And so the onus is on the founder.
Founders are now doing due diligence on whether
that you are actually an accredited investor.
Wow.
And so as a founder, I don't know whether I want to take on that burden or not, right? And so I think there's plenty of vehicles and ways in which to identify accredited investors and go the non-solicitation route.
Yeah.
And I think that the majority of founders in the types of companies that we would back will go that route. You know, will we deal with having, you know, founders that are going the solicitation route? Sure. It's very likely that we will, you know, find ourselves in a situation where that's the case. But I don't see that as being a threat to what we do.
Yeah.
If anything, I think it's a bit of a, should be more of a value add to the community to know who they're dealing with.
Sure. So you're saying that you could potentially see yourselves, or it could happen that you would be approaching founders, or founders would be approaching you for an investment deal, but also they're sourcing for investment funds on an angel list or something other thing else.
Oh yeah.
But then that's just a question of what? Just making sure all teams are on board with the same.
Yeah, yeah. An angel list. I mean, like you're part of the platform. There's a different.
And I should
kind
say what
there,
Naval
right?
Ravikant has done.
Yeah.
And I mean, what both of those guys have done is an incredible.
Yeah.
Frontiersmanship. And I should say, I can't wait to get Naval on the show eventually so we can talk to him about it. So this is not a criticism of this. This is just a new thing.
I don't see any of it as being really harmful to what we do. And at the end of the day, what I think we care about is syndicate construction and making sure that a company has the best trajectory for success going through the seed round. And in my mind, that's a handful of investors like ourselves, so micro VCs that are putting in, you know, a couple hundred K, half a million, maybe a little bit more, and then rounding that out with really value-added strategic angels and investors who are bringing a very specific viewpoint or network to the syndicate. And, you know, but still those deeper pockets like we have, so that the company has a bit more, if they need a bit more runway, they're not going out to 20 different investors to get it.
Yeah, because that could kind of shake things up a little bit.
Exactly.
Right. Let me take a quick break to ask if there are any questions that need to be asked from our audience, since I can't see them. Right. Oh, that's interesting. So I'm assuming the question is about, if I'm getting into business or I'm trying to create a company, should I be conversant in how people do business in China, I guess? And also, I mean, what maybe the broader question is then, what do you see as the future of China and business as it kind of works with U.S. markets and whatnot? Are you working with any founders? I mean, you're talking about Ubly, who does that.
We're talking about Ubly International. We're not talking about bringing Ubly to China yet. Yeah. But, you know, for the most part, again, this goes back to the stage that we invest. We focus on investing in U.S. and,
local,
and local, locally based companies that are launching in the U.S. first.
Right.
And so our companies do go global. Fab's a great example of that. I mean, Fab has, you know, gone to Europe and now they're going into Asia.
Yeah.
And they've gone global pretty very quickly.
Yes.
But, you know, we're focused on having companies at least find that product market fit and success in the U.S. and tackling the U.S. market first.
Yeah.
That being said, you know, is being bilingual and understanding international markets important? Absolutely.
Yeah.
One of the areas that I think is frankly really interesting, I invest in a lot of education companies, is language learning. And the barriers that are coming down to learn languages online today.
Well, that brings to mind a question that I do remember. It was the initial question about the U.S. What do U.S. investors look for?
Yeah.
Arthur, I'm not going to say Arthur's last name. It's a Greek name that I'm afraid I'm not able to pronounce. Sorry, Arthur. But he's always watched the show. He wanted to know, do U.S. investors, and maybe you in particular, have any interest in Australian-based ed tech companies that would be teaching to localize international markets to do English language translation or English language teaching, etc., like that?
Okay, so
is that an interesting market? Do you think that's
is the market? Yeah, potentially the market's interesting.
Yeah.
For me to invest in a company based in Australia would be very difficult.
Yeah.
If Arthur wanted to move to the U.S. and was going to move his team to the U.S., absolutely something we could consider, right?
Yeah.
But typically, we know the U.S. market. There's a lot more we can do to help companies in the U.S. market than we can in international markets in the beginning. But we have lots and lots of founders that end up relocating here.
Right.
Class Dojo is another ed tech company in our portfolio. And Sam and Liam, originally from the U.K., and they came out here to do the Imagine K-12 incubator program, and we invested in them coming out of that, and they've now been able to
stay. And what do you think is happening in EdTech? What makes EdTech interesting to you? Oh,
I love EdTech. So
you're talking to a former teacher as well.
I had at one point
I taught philosophy, literature, Russian, creative writing, theater, and some other arcane subjects.
Cool.
But I taught at the secondary school level, and at the college level I taught like rhetoric 101, stuff like that.
Oh,
but but I in New York I had an EdTech meetup group. It had it has like 670 people in it.
Awesome.
But I'm interested, what's so compelling?
2 years ago, zero investments at our firm in EdTech.
I know. I think ClassDojo is very recent.
ClassDojo was the first one. Yeah. So we did that in 2011, in October of 2011.
Yeah.
And that was one of the cool things about SoftTech is we've got we've got a bunch of areas we invest in, and then we have this one little section called new areas, and that's where we put the things that don't neatly fit.
Is that like a dartboard somewhere, and you just kind of go,
So Oobly is in there too.
Right.
Fitbit when Jeff invested in Fitbit in 2008, that was in there.
Interesting.
So it's a place for us to take some bets that are maybe a little outside of the comfort zone or outside of traditional investments. So we did ClassDojo, and one of the things that enabled us to do ClassDojo was traditionally education software had been sold in through school districts and pushed down. So these very long sales cycles and long time to get into product and into market. And so ClassDojo is an application that teachers download on their phones, sign up their own classrooms, and use without any involvement from the school.
Interesting.
And so so that was one piece. It's disruption around business model and the ability to go direct to teachers. And that was really driven by, this kind of stuff in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So, you have mobile devices.
Bring your
tablets.
Own device, basically.
Bring your own device. And so with devices in the classroom for not just the teachers, but also for the students, there's a way to get distribution that education technology companies were never able to do before.
Interesting.
And so that's sort of begun to open up the market. And so these, shortened sales cycles or no sales cycle, and then maybe eventually sell up, so it's the Dropbox life model, right?
It is interesting. Have you heard of that company Chalkable, which is a BizSpark company? Chalkable is like the app store for all education apps. And they very early on figured out this problem in education, which is there's really no sales cycle, or it's so long that you can't get any adoption of what you're trying to. So what they created was this really sort of front end and back end system of like, how do you get the appropriate ed tech apps and enable teachers to buy them just as they would at the iTunes store or at Windows Marketplace. And they can do it without, the heavy billing and all that stuff.
Yep.
And I can let Zoli Honig, who's the CEO, talk about that on his own. But that's very interesting to me because it's enabling the sort of grassroots of education to kind of push stuff up to the decision makers in a sense,
and it's allowing different types of content to also enter the classroom too. So you've got this whole flipped classroom stuff going on right now, and teachers are able to take videos, whether they're using stuff from Khan Academy or YouTube, or creating their own content through some of the applications out there, letting teachers create their own content. There's just a lot of cool stuff happening in the classroom, and we did ClassDojo. We then did a company called Top Hat. It used to be Top Hat Monocle. Top Hat,
yeah,
which is
I
more focused
that.
On higher ed. They're one of our Toronto companies.
Yeah. They were in Rocket Space for a while.
They were in Rocket
they?
Space, yeah. And then we just did Clever, which essentially creates an API into the student information databases.
Oh, cool.
So it sucks out all the data that it's taking time for teachers to set up these apps in the classroom.
So you're going to facilitate this blended learning model, I guess. Is that's sort of like
that's
you
one
found,
of the
that's
we,
one of the things
yeah,
you could play
Yeah, that's one of the
in.
Things we could, in theory, be. I mean, ClassDojo is about classroom management. It's about giving the teacher back time to teach and not focus on whether
kids
being good or
bad.
Exactly.
Right? So one last question. Why aren't you guys involved in gaming? I don't see any gaming investments.
We used to do a lot of gaming.
Yeah. What's holding you back now?
Right now, just the environment for gaming just isn't great. Yeah. So there's a couple issues. So customer acquisition costs are just really high. It might cost $2 to $3 to acquire a user. There's not just a lot of, it's really hard to discover on platforms. It's not a great environment from that perspective. Difficulty in the public markets with Zynga, and the trickle-down effect that has.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, you're not looking at, and we tend to not think about what's the, mid-level exit look like, but there isn't necessarily a lot of opportunity for acquisition and acquihire right now. And so that combination of factors has just made gaming something that's not a category we're focusing a lot of our energies on right now. In the future, a new platform becomes disruptive, doesn't mean we won't be there again.
Yeah. Is open source and gaming interesting to you, like Linux-based stuff, you know, or do you guys get that technical in the weeds stuff?
We generally don't get that technical
okay,
in the weeds
got
stuff,
it.
Yeah.
Well, I wish I could say it's always a pleasure, but we've only had you here once. Let's hope in the future we can say it's always a pleasure to have you. It's been a great conversation. Thank you, Stephanie Palmieri at SoftTech VC, for sharing your insight. And for anyone else who wants to get in touch with Stephanie Palmieri on Twitter, it's Steph
Palmieri. It's at Steph Palmieri. So it's StephPalmeri.
Got it. And we are going to... Oh, we also have links. Thank you.
Oh.
I'm so glad I have a team here to help me. If you click on more event details on the top of your live streams links up there, you will see more information about Stephanie, but you also see information about how you can join the BizSpark program and how you can get on this show. It's actually incredibly easy. All you have to do is basically get into the BizSpark program and then submit your startup story to us via a Startup Stories tab on the website, and we will review your story and say, wow, you're pretty amazing, and you are one of the three asses we want on the show. So thank you very much, and thank you for SoftTech for letting you come and talk to us.
Thanks.
And we'll see you in the next show, I hope. All
Sounds
right.
Good.